Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Let's say you're Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple. Who are you more worried about? Donald J. Trump or the federal government? Huh? The week that was coming up from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Friday, the 19th of February. Great to have you along, everybody, as always. All right, so listen, let's see. The most valuable company on the planet picks this week to go toe-to-toe with the federal government. Donald Trump on the campaign trail in South Carolina this very afternoon calls for a boycott of Apple. So what do you think? Is that where we start? Yes. Yes, it is. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Sadiq Reddy is at the Wall Street Journal. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so Lynette, you get to go first. Talk to me for a second about Apple and CEO Tim Cook and the downside risk of him drawing this line in the sand.
Privacy is religion in Silicon Valley. Yeah. And so I think that this is something that is, you know, it's just beyond any kind of reason that we could give for, I mean, ISIS is the big bad. Like,
right,
what's worse than ISIS? I can't think of anything else on the planet. On the other hand, we're not exactly sure what this guy's connection was to ISIS. Maybe he wasn't even that close to them. On the other hand, maybe that's the best reason to dig into this thing. It's just, what we're dealing with are Silicon Valley values.
Right.
Coming head-to-head with the American government, and we'll see who wins.
All right, Sadiq, pick that up for a minute and talk to me about the business proposition that Tim Cook and Apple have made now for a couple of years, that encryption and privacy are their calling card, and by gosh, they're going to keep to it.
Well, they are going to keep to it because they're responding to their customers. That's what people want. Right. And Apple wants to stand for more than just being another company that's selling a piece of electronic gadgetry. That half of Americans have iPhones. Half. It's an incredible number for a product that didn't exist a decade ago. And the entire business is predicated on the idea that people will have enough trust and excitement in the product that they're willing to upgrade year after year to a more expensive device. So Apple knows, Tim Cook knows, that people are behind him. And for a company that's larger and more powerful than most governments, it's going to stand on principle for its customers in this case. And it might lose, but at least it's standing on principle.
Well, Sadiq, let me actually stay with you and ask you what, Congress is going to come back at some point. Yes, this is going to be a weird year because of the election. But are we looking now at legislative solutions for this one that Congress is going to get involved because it is such a very big deal?
Congress is certainly going to debate it, whether Congress will actually come to some kind of determination. We all know the state of Congress. We thankfully haven't had to talk about it for a while. But when Congress comes together, at least it is a democratically elected body of the people making a decision like that. And it will be after a debate that Apple has now thrust out into
the open.
Us.
Yeah. All right. So, Lynette, we're going to change gears here. I want to talk macroeconomic stuff, CPI, core inflation. I know it gets no better than this. There's inflation in this economy now, 2.3% year over year, which is more than what the Fed is targeting. What does that mean, do you suppose?
That means that maybe, just maybe, our economy is growing without the help of, the Fed keeping interest rates low. Maybe, just maybe, we can keep this thing going along without it. It's like with we can ride a bike without training wheels, essentially, is what we're saying with the economy. And now maybe the Fed. I mean, I think that there are a lot of macro things going on in the world. China's slowdown, pain in emerging market economies that will still make the Fed pause before they want to raise interest rates. But this is definitely a good sign. And of course, we're still waiting for wage growth.
Right.
But this inflation thing is good. It's Thank you. What we were worried about was deflation.
So right, exactly. Which we were having that conversation 6 months ago. Sudeep, let me actually get you to the global thing. There was a little bit of yin and yang today, right? Or the past couple of weeks. Lots of capital outflows from China, right? Lots of money leaving China. And late this afternoon, news of a deal between Britain and the EU to keep Britain in the European Union. So there's some stability there. Help me make sense of that one.
Well, there's so much uncertainty about the economy, the major economies in, right. in China, in the EU. Then there's the political uncertainty on top of it. And that's what's really causing some of the tension in the EU right now. Obviously, it's causing some tension in the U.S. as well. If it were to provide at least some stability, you can get back to talking about the economic issues, which are considerable and very difficult to deal with, but it's not going to actually resolve them. One reason we've gone through these waves of up and down in a very odd fashion over the last few weeks is that people are just gripped by the fear that everything's going to go down at the same time. We're going to go down this long slide, and maybe, just maybe, this was the week where people have taken a deep breath and said, okay, things aren't necessarily going to go down the tubes right now. Let's
maybe
take it
tomorrow.
One step at a
time.
I was going to end us on an up note. Sudeep Reddy at the Wall Street Journal.
I mean,
Why would we do that? It's Friday.
No,
Lynette Lopez, Business Insider. We got to go. Bye, you guys.
Bye, Kai.
Bye, Kai.
On Wall Street today, it was actually mostly steady and up for the week. Yes, I'm going to take us out on a high note. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Economists love their models, mathematical abstractions of reality that they use to figure out things like optimal rates of inflation, or what happens when trade between countries ebbs and flows, or what conditions are more likely than not to lead to a financial crisis. Of such things, reputations, fortunes, and Nobel Prizes are made. Catch is that sometimes, if a model is glitchy, reputations, fortunes, and Nobel Prizes can be lost, too. Which helps explain why there is a paper out in the journal Science today explaining how economists might build better models and, maybe, better predict the next financial crisis. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains how exactly that might work.
The idea behind this paper is that economists should develop models drawing on something called complexity theory. Allow me to present a very simplified version of what that might mean.
The basic idea in complex systems is that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and that, in particular, it can be dramatically different than the sum of its parts.
Doan Farmer is the director of complexity economics at the Institute for New Economic Thinking at Oxford Martin School. To understand that whole greater than the sum of parts thing, take the example of an ant colony.
An individual ant's a fairly simple organism, but the colony can collectively do very sophisticated behaviors like farming mushrooms and having a war with another colony and things like that. So the economy is, of course, an example of that.
Which, he says, economic models should better reflect. He points to a model he's working on of the housing market in the UK.
We simulate the actions of 5 or 10,000 households.
Households that mirror the age and income demographics of the UK.
And we try and capture the decision-making of each individual household about their savings and consumption, and in particular about how they house themselves.
Even whether they'd qualify for loans. You use the behavior of those individuals to get a sense of the broader housing market. Then, he says, create similar models for the banking industry, also other financial services, and pretty much everything else.
One also needs to be modeling households and firms and the rest of the economy.
When I question the limitations of trying to capture so much, he says weather forecasters can't just look at what's happening over, say, Kansas. They have to look at the whole system. So let's stick with that weather analogy for a minute. David Kolander is a professor at Middlebury College. He says weather forecasting has dramatically improved in recent decades, and this idea might push economic modeling down a similar path. But the economy is even more complicated than weather.
In the economy, unlike the weather, sort of what people think is going to happen can change the nature of what happens. That adds sort of a whole new level of interrelationship that in sort of weather forecasting you don't have.
So in other words, you think we should go down this road, but you're still a little bit skeptical that it...
For anybody who says it's going to give us answers, I'm very skeptical about. It's going to give us better questions and sort of slight insights into better answers.
He sees this type of modeling as a natural progression, not a crystal ball. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
. 2015 was a record year for federal firearm background checks. Almost 23 million people in this country went into gun shops and bought or tried to buy guns. Paul Barrett, a senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, spent 3 days behind the sales counter at a gun shop out in Nevada to see what that business is like on the inside. Paul, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Tell me what this place was like, the West Side Armory.
Yeah, it's a surprisingly cheerful, ordinary shopping mall store, except what they're selling is not Starbucks coffee or muffins, but instead Smith & Wesson and Glocks.
What's the big seller?
The semi-automatic pistol. In this case, they had a sale going with a particular model that has a flashlight attached to it to identify nighttime intruders. $399.99 with the flashlight, down from $500 and change. So it was quite a bargain.
That's really not very much money in the grand scheme of things.
It isn't. The gun market itself, the legitimate gun market, is not a terribly high-margin market. The people selling guns at retail are not making a huge profit off each firearm, so they've got to be in a volume business. They've got to sell a lot in order to make money.
You write that the folks in this store were almost unfailingly diligent in background checks and just being aware of who the purchases are.
Yeah, I think their heart and minds are in the right place. They do perform the background checks, you know, as the law requires, and even go a little further in the sense that under the law, strictly speaking, if a background check is done and the government authority does not resolve the background check within 3 days, the gun retailer, surprisingly, is allowed at that point to go ahead with the gun transfer. Well, this store, West Side Armory, doesn't do that. They will not sell a gun and let it go out onto the street until the background check has been resolved one way or the other. But all that said, it's impossible to avoid all mistakes.
Lots of interesting anecdotes in this article, and I want to talk about a couple of them. The first one is a guy who bought a handgun for his glove compartment, right? Because his earlier one had been stolen, and then the staffer at the store said something interesting to you after the guy walked
out. They just went ahead and did the sale. It was quite routine. And the staff member just turned to me when the guy left and said, well, I hope he's a lot more careful with this one because that stolen gun is on the black market now. People don't steal guns to take them home and put them in a trophy case. They steal guns to use them in crime or to resell them to other people who are going to use them in crime.
Yeah, but but it's a legal sale, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Just because the guy's a bonehead doesn't mean it's an illegal sale.
You got it. So that's a great example of how the legitimate retail sale of guns to, you know, potentially to a law-abiding, if somewhat negligent consumer, can feed the black market. And, you know, there's not really that much for the retailer to do. There's no reason for him to refrain from making that sale, even though he has some reason to believe that that consumer might not be the kind of guy who keeps his car doors locked.
I want to ask you about the owner of this shop. He says at one point in your piece that it makes him sad that fear sells guns in the face of, parenthetically here, declining crime statistics almost everywhere. But the marketing in his store is basically your home is your castle, defend it, and it's all about insecurity.
Exactly. I mean, he would prefer if people were coming in and talking about the shooting sports and target shooting and hunting and so forth. That would be elevating and make him feel like he was part of, you know, sort of an elevated recreational pursuit. The fact is that people come in because they're afraid and they buy a handgun or they, in many cases, buy a second, third or fourth handgun. And he's saying that, you know, other things being equal, he wishes that he wasn't doing fear marketing, but then he has to concede when I show him his own advertising that, yes, he's doing that. And he says, look, I'm just a capitalist. Business is business. And that's the way we do the gun business in this country, for better or for worse.
Paul Barrett is a senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek. His book, by the way, about the subject at hand is called Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. Paul, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Coming up.
It was this hobby that I had. Then slowly I considered that my actual job.
Think about that the next time you put a video of yourself on YouTube, all right? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 21 points this Friday, a tenth percent, 16,391 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 16 points, a third percent, 4,504. The S&P 500, call it flat, 1,917. For the week, the Dow up 2.6%, the NASDAQ up 3.8%, the S&P 500 up 2.8%. Energy companies fell as crude dipped again. Southwestern Energy, which operates natural gas reservoirs, down 16%. Boeing said it has a license from the U.S. to talk planes with Iranian airlines. Boeing, though, down 2% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.75%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Chicago Auto Show has been going on this week, wraps up on Sunday. The show came just as the industry was absorbing the news from Toyota that its Scion brand is going the way of the Honda Element and the Nissan Cube. That is going away. When it hit the streets in the early 2000s, Scion was supposed to be the anti-establishment brand for rebelling Gen Xers. As happens, though, the Gen Xers grew up, and the hot new demographic, millennials, turn out not to be all that interested in being anti-establishment, at least as far as cars are concerned. We sent Nova Sappho to the Chicago Auto Show to find out what young buyers do want in a car.
This one we're really excited about is the all-new hybrid RAV4.
Toyota has a driving obstacle course at the Chicago Auto Show where they show off what their small SUV, the RAV4, can do.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi there.
Hi, I'm Nova.
Professional driver Kevin Krause is my guide on the course, and his sales pitch isn't about an awesome stereo system, customizable spokes, body trims. No, no. He's talking safety features.
We also talk about brake assist features if you have to stop on a hill. We also talk about the technology of backup cameras.
So as I was nodding off, Kevin decided to take our RAV4 on a roller coaster ride, going up a side ramp.
Kevin, you're tilting the car so much, I feel like we're about to tilt over.
I know, but that's part of the testament to Toyota's safety.
Safety, backup cameras, this is the stuff mom and dad care about. But Krause says he's driven around lots of potential buyers in their 20s and 30s who've cared too. Walking around the showroom, Kyle Coley and Crystal Bravo, who are 28 and 26 respectively, are checking out Toyota's hybrids.
I don't really care about like the flashiness of the car. I just really want it to be something that's going to be reliable. It's going to last me for a long time.
Right now, Bravo drives a used Honda Civic. Coley drives a used Nissan Sentra. He's checked out Toyota's younger brand, the Scion, before, but he's not been impressed.
I feel like they're a cheap version of Toyota. I would go with a Toyota over a Scion. I think the quality in just Toyota is much better.
Scions were originally designed to be cheaper, pared-down, customizable cars that look very different than the traditional family sedan. But millennials didn't respond. In fact, Toyota's figures show that almost twice as many people under 35 bought Corollas as they did Scions. And for millennials with higher incomes, that same desire for quality is giving luxury brands a boost.
It's a lot of new money, we call it.
At the auto show's BMW section, salesman Michael Urbano says 40% of his clients are now millennials. And their number one desire is
technology. They all want their phones to work. They all want everything to be hands-free, Bluetooth, USB.
The car industry is listening to all of this because millennials are now a formidable force. Michelle Krebs, a senior analyst at AutoTrader, says they're a third of the market right now, and in a few years, they'll overtake baby boomers.
They absolutely will be changing the way we buy cars, the kinds of vehicles that are out there. They will be a force to be reckoned with for the auto industry.
In shutting down its Scion division, Toyota says it's embracing this change. Andrew Gilliland is the vice president of Scion.
What we're seeing is with the millennials, they're just far more pragmatic about their decisions that they're making. They listen to their parents, which was something that 12 years ago wasn't occurring.
12 years ago, as in around the time the Scion first came out.
Thank you for coming by the Scion display.
At the Chicago Auto Show, Scion is still selling its cars. The brand will keep going until the middle of the year. Mike Cieslak is looking at one of Scion's sportier models.
It's a pretty cool looking car. The trim's really nice. It's just, you know, a very sporty car, and we like sporty cars.
But ask if he's ready to buy one.
No, not really.
Sure, they're fun to look at, he says, but Cieslak is leaning towards a family-friendly SUV instead. In Chicago, I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
If you've spent almost any amount of time poking around online, on YouTube specifically, you've likely run across a comedian named Grace Helbig. She was one of the early finders of YouTube fame. She now has almost 3 million subscribers on her channel. She's had a show on E! As well, that is regular television. She also now has her second New York Times bestselling book out. It's called Grace and Style, The Art of Pretending You Have It, wherein she finds the funny about the world of fashion and style. So good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Why write this book?
Why not?
Because you had to write a book. Is that the deal? It's time to write a book. I've done one. I'm going to do another.
I am a female, turns out.
Yes. I can see.
Thank you. And I love beauty and fashion and that whole world. And it's, to me, always been presented in a very ultra-polished, here are rules, here are expectations kind of way. And so I really wanted to write something that took a much more silly approach to fashion and style to just provide some sort of alternative perspective on it.
I'm going to get in trouble for asking this question,
sure,
but so be it. You poke fun at fashion and beauty.
Yes.
But here you are, and you are perfectly coiffed and well-made up and nicely dressed. You got a snappy black leather jacket
on. Thank you. I like all of this. I like putting on makeup. I like doing my hair. I like buying clothes. I like going shopping. I like all of that. There's a lot that I think doesn't get covered in the world of, like, the effort that goes into it, the trying part. There's always the presentational part where it's like, here's my beautiful makeup done. Here's my beautiful hair done. That I'm always fascinated by the moment of getting to the end result. It's about the process like.
Right. How did you learn to do what you do? This YouTube thing and Snapchat thing and being out there while at the same time, as you say in this book and have said in other interviews, you say you're a very private person.
Yeah. I do 100% consider myself an introvert. And I think introvertedness is not as negative as a lot of people kind of associate with it.
No, I'm an introvert too. I totally get that.
Yeah. And so for me, when I wanted to get in the comedy world and get involved in entertainment, it was always a very push and pull experience because putting myself out there and going to auditions and getting rejected was this emotional roller coaster, as it is for a lot of people. And when the internet presented this opportunity to create whatever you wanted in the comfort of your own home and post it, that to me was the most ideal scenario possible. So it was this hobby that I had. Then slowly I considered that my actual job.
Where do you go from here? You know, Time Magazine has called you one of the most influential women on the internet, right? So basically on the whole planet.
Yeah.
Do you want to do, I mean, you've moved into TV a little bit. Do you want to do that? Do you want to do like feature films and be Kristen Wiig? I mean, what do you want to do?
There's a lot of avenues. Right now, it's such an experimental time. You know, the idea of what is content? What is a television show? Yeah. Is a Netflix series a television show? Not really. It's not. You don't really watch it on TV necessarily. So people are trying to figure out how to create things that people watch in various ways. So there's a lot of different platforms arising. There's a lot of different content vehicles out there. So I've been able to figure out what this umbrella system is, meaning like what kind of content could I create for TV or for stage or for film that still feels within the umbrella of audience that would watch my YouTube videos and hopefully reach some other people that might not know that world.
Is it just you thinking this through, or do you have a posse? I mean, how does Grace Helbig Incorporated work?
I have a manager and an agent, and primarily my YouTube videos are still me by myself with my camera. I do a podcast with a friend of mine named Jack Ferry. Mm-hmm. My two close friends who are also content creators, Hannah Hart and Mamrie Hart, we just wrapped a film called Dirty 30 at the end of last year that'll hopefully be out this summer. Hmm. So there's a lot of pots on a lot of stovetops.
You're kind of living and breathing the gig economy here, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things because I think I started doing improv and started auditioning, I have this innate fear that it could all go away tomorrow.
Yeah.
So I need to have as many pots available to start any sort of meal at any time. But I think that's good too, because right now is such a time to be creative with the way you create content. So I'm really excited to be in that mix.
Grace Helbig, you've heard her and seen her on the internet mostly, TV as well. It's a new book called Grace and Style, The Art of Pretending You Have It. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, an ode to Elon Musk, Nikola Tesla, and some guy named Stu Grossman. Mr. Grossman, an engineer in Silicon Valley, owned until this week the domain name Tesla.com because, his lawyer says, he was a fan of Nikola Tesla, the guy who helped lay the foundation for the modern alternating current electrical system, AC power, as we know it. Mr. Musk, as you may know, runs a company that is in some way also a tribute to Nikola Tesla, Tesla Motors it's called, and he was until today stuck with TeslaMotors.com. The two have apparently reached an agreement, terms not disclosed, which gives Musk more online leeway as he expands that company beyond just cars to battery storage and, in theory, who knows what else. Gotta go. The clock says so. So we will. The Dow off 21 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ up 16 points, a 3%. The S&P 500 flat. Nice week for equities, though. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.